Okay, good morning. So, again, last week was an introduction slash review of the topic of wireless communication networks, and so we looked at some of the basics of just communication networks in general. We looked at a history of voice versus packet networks, so things that were aimed at sending continual streams, predictable streams of data versus things and aimed at sending sort of unpredictable bursty chunks of data. Okay. And so there's a trade-off with those in terms of network design. So depending on how you choose particularly to allocate your resources and trade it off against what sort of data you're sending, you will get an improved use of the network and possibly better or worse data delivery services. Okay. And so in terms of data delivery services, we have this idea of a quality of service, and that refers to things like loss, delay, jitter, and again, depending on what sort of application you have, what sort of data they're trying to deliver, those are more or less important to that application. Okay. The big design split is in terms of basically whether you want to pre-reserve your resources or not. And then we mentioned that for packet switch networks, there was a very specific architecture attached called the layered architecture, which took various data transmission problems or issues, tasks, and sort of handled them, you know, one by one, and in a way so that lower upper layers rely on just immediate one lower layer for their service. Okay, so what we're going to do now is start looking at sort of specifically wireless issues, and in particular the idea of the fact that your method of transmitting your bit now is going to be over a radio link. Okay. So what we're going to do is view this from a sort of point-to-point systems level. So what are the issues that arise in trying to send data over this radio link? The references for this are primarily Stallings. Okay, the book is getting old now, so some of the technological things are fairly out of date, but the basic principles are still there, and they're well explained. Okay. And so what I talk about today would be in chapters 6 and 8. Again, there's loads of other sort of wireless comms books which will again examine the principles for that radio, of what happens over that radio link. Okay. So we're going to take a view from, again, starting with the actual sort of type of data that we're trying to convey and moving that down to, again, how we physically get it onto a link. Okay. So our radio wave, which is what we have to represent bits, is just going to be some sort of sinusoidal signal. And so obviously to represent bits, you're going to have to sort of change the representation of that sinusoid. At the other end of the spectrum, what sort of data are we trying to transmit? Well, it can have many forms. It could be initially an analog voice signal, which would then, again, have to be digitized, or it could be some form of digital data initially. So we're going to have to go through a number of steps to transmit that data. Again, for the moment, we're thinking of over a single link. So if we have an analog signal to begin with, well, we're not transmitting analog signals, we're transmitting bits, so we're going to have to digitize that signal. And again, this is most significant if you have a voice signal. Okay. So your signal is going to have, well, either some fixed number of bits or possibly a bit rate associated with it. And the next question is, can we reduce the number of bits we're sending? So either can we reduce the bit rate or can we, you know, reduce, you know, if it's a fixed number of bits, the number of bits we're sending. Okay. Why would we want to do that? Well, amongst other things, again, our wireless our radio channel is lossy, and so prone to error, and so the less bits we are sending, the less chance of error. Okay. And so then when we've reduced this to be sort of as small as, you know, it's acceptable, we then ask, well, what happens if we do encounter errors? And so to combat that, well, we're going to have to add a bit of information back into our signal or back into our message. Okay, so that redundancy is going to have some information that allows us to either detect that we have an error or, as we'll see in some cases, actually correct the error. Finally, we have our either chunk of bits or sequence of bits that we want to send, and we then have to translate those bits into some sort of waveform sinusoidal representation, which is then transmitted over our radio link. Okay. So we're going to take two lectures to examine this sort of a setup. In the first lecture, we're going to look at the point up to the transmission, so leaving off our actual transmission of a signal, and then, in the second lecture, we will deal with this radio channel and what are the properties of this radio channel. Okay, so we're going to look at some techniques for doing each of the tasks that we've discussed before. So analog to digital conversion, again, this is mainly applicable to speech, compression of either speech or video signals, adding redundancy, so we'll see what the ways in which we can add redundancy are, and again, we can either do it essentially to detect an error and then decide how to deal with it, or in some cases, using convolution coding, we can correct for errors. And then we'll look at, again, our representation of our bits as sinusoidal elements. Okay. Yes?
Can I come back to the previous slide? Because between the second and the third block, we have the messages in digital, but it's not the aim of the analog to digital conversion.
Yes, yeah, so, well, I mean, there's your message was, maybe I should have put it out a bit. The question is, why have the second source? Maybe I should have put the source out here. But your initial source can either be analog or digital. So you could be trying to send a file that's already digital. And so what I'm saying is that doesn't mean
so it's not
an
the
analog
same, it's
to
not
digital.
The same that there's first and another one.
Sorry?
This message is not the same as
a no, message. Different messages. You either have an analog message or it's already digital. Okay. So, performance in this context is referring to the rate at which we can send data, so the capacity we can get out of a channel, and also to issues like error in the system. Okay. So the problem we have is that there is noise present in this channel. Okay. And noise will both limit the capacity of the channel, so it means that you can't just wing off data at ever-increasing rates, and it will also introduce errors into the system. Noise comes from a number of different sources. The first one we have is thermal noise or white noise. And so this is a fairly sort of regular random noise found in our system. And it's uniformly distributed across the system. And it is this noise that we look to as limiting the capacity in the system. And we'll see how in a minute. Other forms of noise refer to different signals interfering with each other, and then just unpredictable or irregular pulses of noise, so that will essentially obliterate a portion of a signal. Okay, so again, cause unpredictable error in the system. So, there is, again, a theoretical limit to relating the to bandwidth of the channel, so how much what rate you can transmit at, the bandwidth of the channel, the signal-to-noise ratio, so how much power, signal power, you're willing to have relative to the noise, and that will give you an upper bound on the capacity of the channel, so what the upper bound on the bit rate that you can achieve for the channel. Now, you'll, at least the fourth years, would prove that in their digital comms module, I'm sure, but we're just going to note that this upper bound exists. This is a theoretical bound and is dependent on the actual implementation of your system and is typically not achieved in practice. Okay. So, just as a sort of a sidebar, our signal-to-noise ratio is frequently expressed in terms of decibels, and a decibel is 10 log 10 of the variable, and so if it's expressed in decibels, then the capacity theorem is not, so you'll have to translate out of the decibels. Now the signal that we're sending is not just a general signal, but a bit. So we can try and normalize our quantity of signal-to-noise ratio in terms of what happens for a specific bit. And so we get EB over N0, where EB is the signal energy per bit, and N0 is the noise power density per hertz. Okay. So we can relate that back to our signal-to-noise ratio by observing that the noise in a signal of bandwidth BT is the density times the bandwidth, so N0 BT, and the signal energy per bit is the S over divided by your bit rate. Okay, so that's how much you're putting in overall, or how much you're putting in to a bit. Okay. So if we plug those two factors in, so we let EB be S over R, and then again, we normalize by our bandwidth BT, then we get, with a little bit of massaging, that EB over N0 is your signal-to-noise ratio times BT over R. Now, R over BT is known as what's called the bandwidth efficiency, And so essentially what it's denoting is what sort of a bit rate can you squeeze into a fixed bandwidth. Okay. And since, again, we have limited bandwidth, we're interested in getting as much bandwidth efficiency as possible. Okay. So, again, at an abstract level, we have a similar concept of what's called spectral efficiency, where spectral efficiency is the ratio of channel capacity to channel bandwidth, so C over B, and again, we'd like that to be as high as possible. We'd like to get as much capacity per bandwidth as possible. Okay. So, again, we can translate that from our signal-to-noise ratio to a relationship with our signal-to-noise ratio to one involving our
EB over N0.
And so, essentially, that leads us to a determination of how much energy we have to put into a bit to give a certain spectral efficiency. Okay. EB over N0 is also related to the bit error rate. So again, please. Intuitively, what you think is the more energy you're putting in relative to your noise, then the better or lower your bit error rate will be. Okay. Exactly what this relationship is depends on modulation techniques, so how you form up your bits. So it gets somewhat complicated. So, again, we're going to relate all of our performance measures to this EV over N0. And, again, we're going to see that we cycle around between those few compromises that we can make, typically relative to the modulation, which a sort of trade-off between, again, these concepts of spectral efficiency and errors, and et cetera. Okay, so we'll return to that when we've sort of marched through our different components for the system. For the moment, what we'll just observe is that we can think of these components as sort of adding potentially sort of almost a noise factor to the system, so changing our EB over N0, or at least we can represent it that way. Okay, so the first thing we're going to look at now is our analog to digital conversion. So this is converting a voice signal into a digital stream. And so we know from Nyquist sampling theorem that you can reconstruct analog signals by sampling them at a rate of twice the bandwidth of the signal. Okay. So we take the bandwidth per voice as being 4,000 hertz. So if we take 8,000 samples per second, then we should be able to fully reconstruct a voice signal. Yeah. If you were thinking of something like music, it would have a much greater range. The instruments can provide, produce higher and lower tones than the human voice. So these samples then have to be further encoded using bits. So we have to represent each sample using a bit or multiple bits. And a typical encoding of each sample is using 8 bits. Okay. So this is leads to the 64 kilobit per second representation of voice signals, okay, and that's considered to be the gold standard of voice transmission, and again, this is what was used for the old telephony systems. You would provide 64 kilobit per second channels through the system. Okay. So the sampling and digitization of voice is referred in that manner is referred to as pulse code modulation or PCM. And there will it does introduce a slight degradation of the signal because you're having to encode the samples. Okay, so it's unlikely that you're So you'll have encoding levels. It's unlikely that your sample's going to hit that level exactly, so you're a little bit off on samples. Okay. This can be viewed as a change to the signal-to-noise ratio. Okay. And yeah, the more levels you use, the more levels you have, then the less of an issue it is. Okay, so here we see we have our signal, and we're sampling that. Our samples will fall. Sort of not exactly, again, on the encoding levels, but you just move it to the closest one, again, introducing a small amount of noise. Frequently, the encoding levels are not evenly distributed because, again, what you want is you also have sort of stronger and weaker signals. You have a change in amplitude, and for lower amplitude signals, you don't want to be losing your contour. So you will have more levels at the lower range, and then less levels at the extreme ranges.
Does the increased sensitivity for lower amplitudes is basically all that had to be agreed, if you like, beforehand?
Yeah. Obviously, yeah, you have to have a sender and receiver, and they have to have...
And was it, like, is that done dynamically, kind of negotiated, or...?
Not that I'm aware of, no. Again, these encodings aren't necessarily used anymore anyway.
Okay.
So. Okay. So, again, that's that would be the sort of basic method for digitizing our voice signal. That's, yeah, at least in, particularly in the early cellular telephone systems, that was a fair amount of bandwidth to be dedicating to any one conversation, and so compression techniques were applied to that sort of basic signal. And so this leads us on to our topic of source encoding. And again, it's a very, you could spend at least a good portion of the module just looking at different encoding techniques as well. We're going to just have a look at a few of the ones related to voice and mention also just what happens for video as well. Okay. So we're attempting to reduce the number of bits we have to send, either as a rate or just as an overall number. Obviously, with voice and video, that it's a rate. Okay. So we can do that in either a lossy or a loss-free manner. So we can do it by, in some way, reducing the quality of what we're sending, or possibly just by being very clever about the structure of the data. And being able to be clever about how we represent it, but sending the same amount of information. Okay. Frequently, these rely on the similarities between, not just within a single sample, but between one sample and the next. Okay. So we can look at not just... If we're looking at streaming, we look at not just one transmission, but a sequence. Okay. So speech coding, encoding, looks at two things. We can think of, again, our pulse code modulation as being our baseline. And then are there clever things we can do to... change our sample representations and get our bit rate down. Okay. And we'll see that we can drop our rates a fair amount, but things like delta modulation have really poor quality, so you're trading off between quality and rate. So there's only so far that trade-off can go. So a second class of encoding is what's called linear predictive encoding. So that'll move away from the idea of representing each sample to one of trying to come up with a mathematical model for our voice signal that can be parameterized and then just ship off the parameters. Okay. So if we start with our sort of modifications of pulse code modulation, the first thing, again, that we can think is, well, again, maybe if we look at consecutive samples, we can do something there. And in particular, we assume that consecutive samples are not, the difference is not going to be large. Okay, so you're not going to jump from one end of the range to the other. Okay, so instead of sending the actual sample, we're going to send the difference between the samples. So you start with a single sample, then you send how that one changes from the last one and the next one and the next one. Since we assume that difference is not huge, we should be able to encode it using less bits. This is a lossy compression in that, again, if your sample does change rapidly, then you can't represent that, and so you will lose some quality to the signal. So, just continuing on with that idea, well, maybe it would help us to look at not just the immediately previous sample, but go a few back. Again, if you're looking at more than one, then you can sort of start inferring things like rates of change, etc. Okay. And so now we can send less information about a single difference and then infer from what we've seen before exactly what the next sample is. Okay. And so again,
under a wave of samples, like samples, the original samples, or are you reusing what you think?
Well, you might use the original samples would be used in the transmission, but obviously you don't have those at the receiver, so it's the received signals would then be used. The received samples would be used in the decoding.
Okay, before the encoding, if you like, to get, say, the N samples, are they the N, original N samples, or some of them have been the product of weighing earlier samples?
I believe that what is sent is just the current difference, but you use the samples plus this to get a better prediction, a better idea of what, this is how trigger quantizations, but you can use the previous samples to, again, adjust this, adjust what's sent to give you a more accurate current sample.
Okay, so you were just saying if you kept the last fives, if the N was 5, you have the last 5 original samples, which may not be quite what you actually sent, but that's what you used to do your weight average.
Okay. So what sort of at an extreme, you can try and sort of follow the shape of your signal using only a single quantization and saying that it's either going up or down. Okay. And so in this case, you get this stair step up, followed by stair step down. And so you're following the general curve of your signal, but not terribly accurately. The quality of the recovered signal is fairly bad. If the primary of this encoding would have been in the military, well, it just, well,
doesn't matter. It's what the quality is. You just need to get the basic information transmitted. Okay, so all of these are an attempt to, again, transmit the basic, those basic sample sequences. Okay. And then having our sample, our sample string, then recreate our signal. Yeah. And the problem is that attempts to reduce, to significantly reduce the bit rate at which you're sending, so the amount of information you're sending, do lead to poor, very poor quality recreation of the voice. So, an alternative approach was to build a parameterized model of our of the human voice. And then instead of transmitting samples, we're just transmitting parameters for that model. Okay. The basic transmission for that, which again insists it's not a terribly great or not a terribly good recreation of the human voice, but you can get down to about 4.8 kilobits per second. Okay, it will sound quite synthetic, although decodable. Okay, so here we look at a chunk of our voice signal, typically 20 microseconds at a time. And we, again, model that chunk. In particular, we have a model for the speech, and then we analyze what the appropriate parameters of that model are for that specific chunk. Okay, and then just transmit our parameters. Okay, so the key parameters are volume or loudness, pitch, so high or low, and so then you get obviously the signal, and that is then the human sent through the vocal cord, and the vocal cord, the vocal tract, and that's the sort of has further impact on the signal, so the signal will echo through, resonate through your vocal tract. Okay, so you can model each of those components and again parameterize them to come up with a mathematical model of how sound is actually produced in the human vocal system. Okay. You then just chip off those parameters and you recreate it at the other side. Okay, so the vocal cord synthesizer is generating a series of impulses at different frequencies,
then you add appropriate, if you're not actually saying anything, you just add white noise. And then again, the vocal tract will
model how the sound would interact with, you know, a physical vocal cord. Okay. And so the encoding is attempting to, again, minimize a mean square error between the predicted signal and the actual signal. Okay. So that's the basic idea of how you would send a signal, again, just as a parameterized, a bunch of parameters for a model. We saw we could get down to a fairly low bitrate doing that. Again, straight LPC sounds quite synthetic. So the next question is, how do you improve that without, you know, again, upping the bitrate too much? And so the idea is that you try to now model the residue signal, so what got left out in our model, to improve our LPC, but without increasing the bit rate too much. So what we do is we typically have a code book, a bunch of these residues, and so we, at the sending end, you decide which residue is most appropriate, which residue is closest to the actual residual value, and you, again, send back information along with your parameters. And so then that is added to your LPC signal to produce a better quality voice signal. Okay. Okay. So again, you can, in this way, you can get reasonably good quality voice signals at relatively low bit rates. And that's the technique that would be used in cellular telephony systems. Similar ideas can be used for other forms of compression. Again, compression can get very clever. Just to give you some simple ideas of doing video compression, again, your original video is going to be a sequence of images. Okay. And so we'll have some rate at which the images are recorded, so say 24 per second. Each image then is going to be encoded as an array of pixels, and each pixel then, of course, has to be encoded as a number of bits. So we can use coding both within and between our different images to reduce the amount of information we have to send. Within the image is referred to as spatial encoding, and from one image to the next is referred to as temporal encoding. Okay. So, again, spatial encoding can get quite clever, but the first sort of obvious thing you can think of is it's similar to the idea of those voice not changing a lot. Within an image, adjacent pixels are likely to be either the same or close to each other. So we can think of, instead of sending each pixel value, we send a single pixel value, and then
the number of pixels that applies to. So if you look at the sky, this whole row, so it'd be the same pixel value. So you don't have to send it again and again and again. You just send one, and then how far you go, maybe multiple rows. So in that way, again, you can reduce the amount that's of information needed to represent a single image. Then the next thing to note, obviously, is that from one image to the next, you're not going to have a huge amount of change. So there will be some motion, maybe some change in the lights, but probably not a lot. So the sky will have moved a little. But you should be able to represent the second image more efficiently by sending the change between the two images rather than resending the whole image. Okay. So, our original recording is what's called constant bit rate. So, each image, it's the uncompressed version. So, each image is of a fixed size, and you're sending or you're generating those images at a fixed rate. Typically, what compression does is it leads to a variable bit rate signal because, again, the amount you're able to reduce each frame by is changing, and also whether you're sending an actual image or again, the change between the images, which is, again, less information, is changing. Okay. So, again, typically these will be, these can be either lossy or lossless, depending on, again, exactly how you're compressing these images. And, are we worried about recreating the image exactly, or do we think an approximation is good enough?
So again, depending on how we do this, we would get sort of a maximum bit rate, and this can vary depending again on what encoding you're using. Okay. So again, we can think of, depending on whether we have a lossy or lossless method, if we have a lossy method, we can again think of that as in some way increasing the noise in the system and degrading the signal. So, which or whichever, you now have a digital signal. And we want to send this along, but we know that it's probably not going to get through without potentially some problem. We are going to lose some of the bits. Maybe not for every
signal you send, but if you send a stream, then a certain percentage will be lost. If you send a block, then perhaps a bit within the block would be lost or not. But we need to have some method for then handling that loss. So again, you can think, well, at a very minimum, you need to be able to decide that you have lost something. And possibly you need to, then once you know you've lost something, you need to decide how you're going to handle that loss. Okay. The only way you can know this is to add some additional information back into the system. So some redundancy, some additional representation of your signal. Okay. So you're going to increase now the number of bits that you transmit relative to those used to transmit the information itself. Okay. We're going to assume that this increase in bits allows us to detect errors. And then, again, the question is, well, what do we do if we detect errors? Short of doing nothing, which is sometimes what you do, if you actually want to fix it, then you can drop your packet and request that it be resent. Or, depending on how you add on your information, it's possible in some cases that you can reconstruct the original correct information sent. Either way, again, you need to add, if your channel is going to introduce loss, you're going to need to add some way of combating that loss. Okay. We have two methods that we turn the table down again. Well, we have two methods that we can use detect our loss, and the first is block coding, and so your data is going to be divided into chunks, and then for each chunk you're going to add some information, some redundancy per chunk, and then you'll look at that information to decide whether that chunk of data is correct or incorrect. Our second method that we're going to look at is convolution coding, which deals with then streams of data. So again, you should have seen the basics of block coding in any sort of basic networks module. We're dividing our data into chunks, then we're just adding a few extra bits and using those to decide if our data was in error or not. Typically for this, if an error is detected, either you just drop that block and if you don't care, then you just leave it, or if you really need that data, you ask for it to be resent. Okay, so the most basic piece of redundancy you can send is what's called a parity bit. And so the idea behind a parity bit is that you want to keep either the number of zeros or the number of ones either even or odd. In this case, we're going to say that we want the number of zeros to be even. So you have your data. And in our data, we have seven zeros. If we want an even number, then we add a zero to make that eight zeros altogether. Okay. So what happens if you have an error? Well, if a 1 changes to a 0, you're not going to have 9 zeros. And you say, oh, well, that's not what I wanted. So there's an error. If a 0 changes to a 1, again, you're going to have back to 7 zeros. And similarly, you can work out if that changes to a 1, again, you're going to have 7 zeros. So, if you have a single error within your block, you can detect it and then take whatever action. The nice thing about that is that's about the smallest amount of information you can send. The problem with it, what happens if two errors occur, so two of the bits are flipped? You just won't know. So, there's a limit to the usefulness. You can improve somewhat by doing block parity checks. So you arrange your data into rows and columns and do a parity check on each row and column. You can detect and correct single errors, but if you think about it long enough, you will eventually get to the point where you cannot detect an error.
It'll take you a few more errors, but you get to the point where you can't necessarily detect an error. Okay. There's
theory about how much code you have relative to how many errors you can detect, but again, that's not
useful to us.
One, just to mention, the cyclic redundancy check is one of the most common methods of detecting errors in data, mainly because it's good at it doesn't have this issue with the parity bits that you're likely to miss an error. So for sending a relatively small amount of extra bits, you get good error detection possibilities. Okay. And the idea here is that we have what's called a generator. And so we want the code word that we send, so the data plus redundancy that we send, to be divisible by the generator. Okay. Evenly divisible without remainder by the generator. Okay. And what we have to do, essentially, is be very clever about how we take our generator, and that gets into
some fairly deep mathematical theory. But for our purposes, once the generator has been picked, we can just use it to check whether or not our signal is correct. So we attempt our division. Since that's not working, what we see is that in this case we end up with a remainder, so we assume that there was an error in our original signal. So this is, again, a very good code for detecting errors. Now, so generally, CRC can, in theory, be used to correct errors as well, but in general, it's not. Generally, those block codes are used strictly for the detection of errors. There's a second class of coding which acts on streams of data. And so it encodes not just the current block of data, but uses, again, history, previous blocks of data within the encoding as well. Okay. So it's not just take a block and add some bits to it. Now you take an input stream of blocks and you use that to generate an output coded stream. Okay. So you don't, again, send the original blocks, you send just this coded stream. So we say now that our the encoding has memory, so we divide our stream up into small blocks of k data bits, and for that we produce a coded block of n bits, and the coded block is going to use the current block plus k minus 1 previous blocks to produce our coded block. So we use not only the current data, but also in history. And what that means is that you're getting some representation of any block of data in multiple pieces of our coded stream. Typically, you have relatively small numbers for NK, and the memory depth capital K. So, for our example, we might produce 2 bits. For every one in, and the production involves not only our current bit, but also the 2 previous bits in the stream. And so we can, the measure of how much redundancy are we, different sort of redundancy are we adding, or how much extra data do we have to send is captured in the coding rate, which is the original rate, the original number of bits relative to the codes produced. Okay, so in our example here, for every 1 bit of data, we produce 2 bits of code. Yeah, and so what you might think about that is that it's fairly expensive to do this sort of encoding, but the plus of it is that what we'll see is you can, if there are errors, you can recover your original signal. So again, producing a good convolution code is a complex matter. What we're going to do here is just look at how it works and get some appreciation of what it can do. Okay, so what we'll see is it's relatively easy to implement, so we'll have a shift register implementation. The state of the system is, again, the bits plus history that we need, or the history that we need to make our decisions. And the reason it's nice, the reason that representation is nice is because we can unwind it through time, and by trying to trace through that unwinding, we'll arrive at a method of correcting for errors. Okay, so we're going to look at an example of how it works. Okay. So this, in our example, for every 1 bit input, we produce 2 bits of output, and each of those outputs is based on the current bit plus the 2 previous bits. And so we define our generator function for the output, and in this case, for our first bit that we're generating in the output, we are just exclusive ORing together our 3 bits for memory, so our current plus 2 memory bits, and for the second, we exclusive OR our current bit and 2 previous. Okay. So again, we haven't said how or why we picked that function, but we're just using that as the example function that we did. So, again, what happens is dependent on our history, so the 2 previous bits plus the current bit, and so we can represent that using a finite state machine. So the state of the system is the history, so the 2 previous bits, and when the next bit arrives, well, it's going to change that history because it will then essentially become one of the previous bits. And depending on what state you are in when that bit arrives, you will get output. So you will get your code out. Okay. So when we start out, we assume that we're in the 0-0 state, and then either a 0 comes along or a 1 comes along. If a 0 comes along, what happens to the history? Well, it's still 0-0. Okay. What is the output? Well, if you exclusive OR zeros together, you still get 0. So in both cases, you get 0. So the output is 0-0.
Now what happens if a 1 comes along? Well, your history changes. Now you have 1, 0 for the history for the next time. And our output is 1 exclusive OR with 0 is 1, exclusive OR with 0 is 1, or 1 exclusive OR with 0 is 1. So our output is 1, 1. And so when we're generating our coded output, we can essentially, just mentally think of we're moving through this state machine. So if we had 1, 1, 1, we'd be generating 1, 1, 0, 1, 1, 0, and we'd end up in state 1, 1. So, in terms of generating our output, well, this is actually enough, but it's helpful to have this state machine representation when you start thinking about decoding your signal. Okay. So, if we then go to encoding, if we have a sequence 0, 1, 1, 0, then again we get out 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, and then 0, 1. Okay. And again, if you assume that there are no errors, then it's easy enough to go back the other way as well. So if you started out, if you saw 0, 0, you'd know you had a 0. 1, 1, you'd know you had a 1. 0, 1, you'd know you had a 1. And 0, 1, you'd know you had a 1.
Okay. So we can think about unwinding that state machine as time goes by.
And this gives us what's called a trellis diagram. So at any point in time, you think of, again, the new bit arriving, and so you think about what states are reachable, okay, as that new bit arrives. You start out, obviously, if you start in a specific state 0, 0, then you can only go either A or B. The next time around, you could be in A or B, and then you can go to A, B, C, or D, and you get this sort of regular representation of the state machine as time goes by.
If there's no errors, again, you're going to
trace your way through this trellis diagram exactly.
So the question then becomes, what happens if we do encounter errors?
So presumably, you should be able to detect it. Let's think about a single error. You won't be on the path anymore.
But again, what we're keen to do is correct the error. Okay. And so if you want to correct the error, what you do is you think about what the most likely path through the system is. And because you encoded your bit in multiple output streams, there should be some information in there that allows you to do that. Okay. So, the process of finding the most likely path through the system then is referred to as the Viterbi algorithm. And when we say most likely path, we mean the one for which you change the least bits. Okay. So you can, for instance, get to this point over many, many paths, but depending on what your encoding has been, you'll have to change more bits of the encoding to do so. And so what we're going to do is try to find one which is clearly
better, clearly change less stuff to get there.
Okay. So what we want to do is compare the received sequence with all possible sequences and choose the closest one. Okay, and by close we mean, again, changing the least bits. In theory, if we did this, if we went on for longer and longer periods of time, we'd probably come closer, but we can't do that, so what we do is we examine the sequence for a fixed period of time, a fixed window size. So we're going to examine B blocks. And so within that window, we try to eliminate less likely paths. So if you have two paths arriving to the same state, and one of them changes more stuff, you eliminate the one that changes more stuff, and you see the one that changed less. What we hope is that at the end of this comparison, then at least for the first sequence, we have a single winner for what the first code should have been. Okay. So we start, we want to determine our first block. We look at a B block sequence to do so. By the time we've looked at the blocks, we hope that we, again, have a clear notion of which fork to take. So we'll have eliminated all paths related to one, and we're left with paths related to the next. Okay. If we succeed in that, then we say that, well, that edge that we've chosen is the correct first input. And if we don't succeed, then we just say, okay, well, we give up, we can't correct that error.
Okay, we then move on to the next block and the next block and the next block.
So, again, to see how that works, we have a window size of 7, so we're going to look at the first 7, first 7 transitions, and we see that our first one
10 is not one of our possible codes, so we know that there's a problem. The question now is, can we fix that problem? And so what we do is we trace our progression, and we ask the question, well, how many blocks do we have, how many bits do we have to change to have made that sequence? Okay, so we start out, obviously we're in A, and we can either stay in A or go to B. And each of those requires that you change one bit. So just by, obviously, just by examining that, you can't say anything. You then move on to the next transition. And so, again, we are 0, 1. So to stay A or B, or to move from A to B, you'd have to change one bit either way. To move from B to C, you would have had to change both bits, so we have 0, 1, that's 1, 0. And to move to from B to D, you would have actually been okay. You keep going on and accumulating paths, but what we see is that we can start eliminating paths as well. So from here, we could reach C or D, but it would take us a greater change, so we don't need to continue considering that. So we only continue with the paths that have lower Hamming distances. And so we continue with that at each step. Again, we pare away paths that have higher Hamming distances. And what we see at the end, by step 6 and then where we stop at step 7, is again that we pared away all the paths that started with 0, 0. Okay. So that all of those paths have led to higher Hamming distances than following paths that go from 0, 0 to 1, 0 nodes. So we can conclude from that that there that the probability is that our original code was 1-1, and therefore our original input bit should be a 1.
So that's a bit tricky. It does require sit down and think about it. I will give you a couple of sample problems in the tutorials to sort of let you think about that. But the bottom line of it is that, again, you can... not only detect errors, but correct them. And you'll have a good probability of having corrected it the right way and not the wrong way. Okay, so again, particularly when you have streams of data being sent, that's a handy way to do your encoding, and it allows you to recover errors. Naturally, things get more complicated from there. That's, you know, sort of the basic design, and then you can
make that fancier in order to try and improve your forward error correction possibilities. And the class of codes that's popular in that respect is turbo coding. And turbo coding uses this basic convolution coding, but then makes it a bit more fancy. It splits the data encoding into the original stream and the and interleaved stream. So it rearranges one stream rearranges the data in order to guard against first errors, and then it encodes those streams, then alternates which encoding it's sending. So it's complex. Okay. So here you send your you send your basic stream, and then you send encoded versions, and again send one or the other encoding.
Okay, so one example again that's used in practice is voice encoding in GSM, so in your basic cellular, your 2G cellular systems. And here, you see we use a combination of encoders. So we consider some data to be very important, so your parameterization of your voice model, for instance, or certain parameters for your voice model. And you know, these we decide, well, if they don't get there, then there's not much use in the signal. So we have a block code. We block encode those. Because, again, if they're wrong, we just consider the signal to be able to block the wrong. Okay. We then have 132 important bits, and a few extras, and then 78 bits. You know, if it gets there, that's a bonus. Okay. So, we block and code our very important bits. Then we convolution code our very important plus important bits. And we then add that to the not-so-important bits and send that signal. Okay. And so what we see is that we've increased our data rate use again our reported data. We've sort of done a double check on, and if the imported data is incorrect, then we just and remember this is incorrect after we've decoded it through our convolution code. So if that's the case, then we just drop the block. Okay. And you know, again, one nice thing about voice is that, again, as we say, loss is a certain amount of loss is tolerable. You know, through the human ear, you just interpolate between one sample and the previous sample. Okay. So the whole, the important, and again,
somewhat important bits are all convolution encoded. And so, again, this is going to allow us to attempt to get a correct version out at the other end.
Okay. So, again, what we've seen is that there's two basic forms of encoding. We have our block coding and our convolution coding.
Convolution coding is nice for streams of data, and it's allows a relatively easy way to perform forward error coding.
Forward error correction. Okay.
So, again, we have added bits now in order to increase the reliability of our data stream. Okay, then this again can be related to our bit error rate and our bit energy to noise density. Okay. And so then what we see is that with coding, then in general our bit error rate decreases. Again, the exception to that is if you're essentially sending very weak signals, so if you've got a lot of errors, then essentially you're going to get worse because if
everything has changed, you're more likely to sort of again get to a worse place with coding. Okay, so that's went on for a fair while. We only have one topic left, which is modulation. And essentially we're going to mention some of the basic forms of modulation and again how they feed into or how they can potentially feed into performance. As we go through the course, we'll be looking at more sophisticated modulation techniques as well. So I'm going to call a break now, so a 15-20 minute break, and then we'll finish off with that topic. It probably won't take too long.